drivers and advocates are doing to change it. And after 7:30, the new Greens leader, Larissa Waters, is my guest. She'll be talking about the priorities for the party in this next term of Parliament. News time now. It is 7 o'clock.
ABC News. Good morning, I'm Simon Lauder. The Prime Minister is about to leave Indonesia for Rome as he prepares to attend the Pope's inauguration mass. Here's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jegits.
Anthony Albanese has concluded his visit to Jakarta and is now turning his attention to Rome. A host of world leaders are expected to attend the Pope's inauguration mass, and there will be a hive of diplomatic activity on its sidelines. Anthony Albanese has already flagged he'll meet Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney and French President Emmanuel Macron, but it looks like he won't get a chance to meet US President Donald Trump. The administration has now announced that Vice President J.D. Vance will lead the US delegation to the event.
The new Greens leader, Larissa Waters, says she's proud her party held up Labor's housing legislation last term because it led to a better outcome. The Greens' refusal to back the government's Housing Australia Future Fund legislation forced Labor to boost the fund by more than $1 billion. But Labor campaigned hard against the Greens in the recent election, framing the minor party as obstructive. Senator Waters says her party got results.
I am so proud that our tough negotiations on that housing bill led to $3.5 billion of extra funding for social homes. There are people now that are going to have somewhere to live because of that tough negotiation. So I'm proud of that. And as I said, we are going to be firm but constructive.
Detectives are piecing together the movements of a communal crime car allegedly used in the arson attack on the Adas Israel Synagogue in Melbourne's southeast last December. Costa Haritos reports.
Police say the allegedly stolen blue Volkswagen Golf sedan was used in an arson attack at the Lux nightclub in South Yarra in Melbourne's inner south last November. Today, a 22-year-old man will face court charged with several offences, including criminal damage by fire and theft of a motor vehicle, while a 21-year-old man was released yesterday pending further inquiries. Detectives believe the same vehicle was spotted weeks later on the night of an arson attack at the Adas Israel Synagogue in Ripon Lee. Police say there are no indications the men arrested yesterday were directly involved in the synagogue fire or that the nightclub fire was politically motivated.
Paramedics in Gaza say at least 85 people have been killed in another deadly day of Israeli strikes across the territory. Here's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran.
Israeli forces have targeted claimed Hamas sites up and down the strip, with Jabalia in northern Gaza one of the hardest hit areas in the last 24 hours. Many of the bodies being taken to morgues are those of women and children. Hamas has said the attacks show Israel is desperately trying to negotiate a ceasefire and hostage release deal under fire, while the Prime Minister of Qatar, a country which has been trying to broker an agreement between Israel and Hamas, says the recent heavy strikes are further evidence Israel just wants to continue the war. Matthew Doran, ABC News, Jerusalem.
Negotiations between Ukraine and Russia to end their war look set to proceed in Turkey today following a week of diplomatic wrangling. Eric Torcek reports from Istanbul.
These will be the first direct negotiations between Ukraine and Russia in 3 years. The Ukrainians have criticised Russia's choice of representatives, saying they lack authority and their selection showed Russia was not taking the talks seriously. But Ukraine nevertheless has agreed to send its defence minister to meet them. The talks could advance a proposal for a 30-day ceasefire, which Ukraine has already accepted. The Russian delegation says it wants to address what it called the root causes of the conflict. Eric Dworchek, ABC News, Istanbul.
There are concerns for unvaccinated children in Papua New Guinea after a polio outbreak was declared. PNG correspondent Marion Farr reports.
The World Health Organization declared the outbreak yesterday after detecting community transmission of the virus. The PNG government has now launched a response plan aiming to immunize more than 3 million children across the country. PNG currently has extremely low vaccination rates, with less than 50% of the population vaccinated against polio. The last polio outbreak was in 2018, but it was quickly brought under control. Marion Farr, ABC News, Port Moresby.
The Australian government says it will send two experts to Papua New Guinea to assist in its response to the polio outbreak following a request from PNG. You're listening to ABC News. NATO says it's in close contact with Estonia after Moscow briefly sent a military jet into its airspace following an incident with an oil tanker bound for Russia. Here's Europe correspondent Catherine Diss.
The Jaguar was placed under sanction by British authorities last week. On Tuesday, Estonia tried to detain it, accusing it of sailing illegally without a flag. The crew on board the ship refused, and then Russian authorities sent a military jet into NATO airspace to check on the situation for close to 1 minute. The Estonian Navy escorted the ship to Russian waters, and its government has warned Moscow is flexing its muscle in the strategic sea. The Jaguar is one of more than 100 ships in Moscow's so-called shadow fleet, which is how Western countries describe Russian vessels avoiding their sanctions.
Britain and Germany have announced plans to jointly lead the development of a European missile with a range of more than 2,000 kilometres. German Defence Minister Boris Pistorius says it's clear the continent has to close what he calls capability gaps as quickly as possible. It comes amid fears over both the threat posed by Russia and the extent of America's commitment to defend Europe. Lawyers for hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs have begun their cross-examination of his former long-term partner Cassie Ventura. North America correspondent Lauren Day reports from the court in New York.
The defence team has shown the jury a number of explicit messages between the pair, which appear to show Ms. Ventura expressing her desire for the marathon sexual encounters known as freak-offs and offering to organise them. They've also been focusing on Mr. Combs' drug use and behaviour when withdrawing from drugs. However, when defence attorney Anna Estevao asked Ms. Ventura what Sean Combs was addicted to, she replied, success. When the defence clarified they were talking about substances, Ms. Ventura said opiates. Lauren Day, ABC News, New York.
Back home, where the third week of the Supreme Court trial of Erin Patterson concludes today in the regional Victorian town of Morwell. Jared Whittaker reports.
Erin Patterson has pleaded not guilty to murdering three of her lunch guests by serving them a beef Wellington containing poisonous mushrooms at her regional Victorian home in July 2023. Prosecutors allege she deliberately cooked the meal with death cap mushrooms and feigned illness to avoid suspicion. The court heard leftovers from the lunch and a food dehydrator discarded by Ms. Patterson tested positive for death cap toxins. Yesterday, Justice Christopher Beale dismissed a member of the jury after receiving reports that he had discussed the case with outsiders.
A memorial will be held in Brisbane today for a Queensland police officer who went missing near a northern New South Wales beach earlier this year. Danielle Maher reports.
Inspector Jay Nataro went missing after visiting Broken Head, south of Byron Bay, on the 25th of March. The 45-year-old's car and surfboard were found at the beach by a member of the public, and a search was declared when he failed to show up for work at Ipswich Police Station or answer his phone. But those search efforts were suspended 2 days later. The Queensland Police Service will hold a memorial for the inspector in Brisbane today for invited family, friends and colleagues. Mr. Nataro family has asked for privacy.
Now with sport, here's Daniela Intilli.
New South Wales has won the Women's State of Origin Rugby League Series with a 26-6 win over Queensland in Game 2 at the Sydney Football Stadium. It's the Blues' first series win in 3 years and first under new head coach John Strange. Dally M medalist Olivia Koenig claimed Player of the Match honours for her performance, which included 2 tries. The win hands the Blues an unassailable 2-0 series lead. Koenig told ABC Sport she's thrilled to clinch the series.
Yeah, I'm just super proud, and we've worked so hard the last 6 weeks in our training block and this week in camp. So, yeah, just super stoked and happy.
The Gold Coast Suns have held off Hawthorn to jump to second on the AFL ladder with an 8-point win to open the Sir Doug Nicholls round. Tonight, the Swans host Carlton at the SCG. And Australian cyclist Caden Groves has won Stage 6 of the Giro d'Italia in a sprint finish, but compatriots Jai Hindley and Jay Vine were caught up in a mass crash that forced several riders to pull out.
To finance and on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.65%. The broad S&P 500 gained 0.4%, but the Nasdaq lost 0.2%. Oil is sharply lower. The global benchmark Brent crude trading at $64.57 US a barrel. The Australian dollar is weaker this morning at just over 64 US cents. You're up to date with the very latest ABC News.
Across Australia, you're listening to Breakfast on ABC Radio National.
Good morning, welcome to AM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. US President Donald Trump says peace talks between Russia and Ukraine, due to be held in Turkey today, are unlikely to achieve a breakthrough. President Trump says nothing will be achieved until he sits down with Vladimir Putin, a meeting which is yet to be arranged. After speculation that President Putin would turn up to today's talks, the Kremlin instead sent a low-level delegation. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of not taking the summit seriously. Europe Bureau Chief Mazoe Ford reports from Istanbul.
As the call to prayer rang out across Istanbul at sundown, the meeting many around the world were waiting for hadn't happened. But after a lot of I'll go if he goes and we won't go if they won't go, there now appears to be some certainty about those who will and won't go to the Russia-Ukraine peace talks. Neither Russian President Vladimir Putin nor his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky will attend. Instead, they're sending ministers, diplomats and defence officials. Moscow's team will be led by presidential aide Vladimir Medinsky.
Our official delegation has been appointed by the president's order, and it has all necessary jurisdictions and powers to negotiate.
This has made Ukraine nervous because Mr. Medinsky helped lead the 2022 peace talks, during which Ukraine accused Russia of demanding its surrender instead of seeking to negotiate. Maria Kolmakova is a Ukrainian journalist in Istanbul covering the talks.
We are thinking that Russians is not seriously because, as you can see, the delegation is not senior as we expected.
Also covering the meeting, Russia 24 TV anchor Konstantin Chirikov. He had this to say about the seniority of the Kremlin's delegation.
They're very serious people, so they're enough experienced on this track. So the fact that these names are nothing for Western press is not showing that they're not experts and professionals. They're huge professionals. Just Google it, okay?
When President Putin suggested these talks after threats of fresh Western sanctions, President Zelensky challenged him to meet in Istanbul face to face. When Mr. Putin said he wasn't going, Mr. Zelensky announced he'd send his defence minister Rustem Umerov, who's best known for negotiating prisoner exchanges. If a 30-day unconditional ceasefire can't be agreed, Mr. Zelensky says the West must act.
Russia doesn't feel it needs to end the war. And so we say, if there's no ceasefire, if there are no serious discussions being made, we want more sanctions to be applied to provide a stimulus to end the war quickly.
Speaking on board Air Force One, US President Donald Trump says he doesn't believe there'll be a ceasefire yet.
Nothing's going to happen until Putin and I get together, okay? And obviously he wasn't going to go. He was going to go, but he thought I was going to go. He wasn't going if I wasn't there. And I don't believe anything's going to happen, whether you like it or not, until he and I get together.
Here in Istanbul, the Turkish government is hoping the meeting they host will be a step towards easing the deep hostility. But it's a big ask when both sides have such deep distrust. This is Mazoe Ford in Istanbul, reporting for AM.
The Pacific region has some of the highest rates of domestic and gender-based violence in the world. In some countries, studies show that 2 out of 3 women are victims of abuse. Now, survivors, female politicians and advocates are sharing their stories and pushing for change. Alice Lolihia has this report.
On Christmas Eve 2024, Fijian politician Linda Tambuya found out that an explicit video of her was being shared online without her knowledge or consent.
Women are targeted 10 times more online than men. We continue to perpetuate the patriarchy and the discrimination online which existed offline.
Ms. Tambuya was dismissed from her cabinet position after the incident and faced a wave of cyberbullying and harassment.
I was just dismissed. And very, very abruptly, without much explanation. So, you know, it was like I felt I was being punished twice.
The Fijian government has not responded to questions about her dismissal, and the police are investigating how the video came to be online. But Shamima Ali, the coordinator of Fiji's Women's Crisis Centre, says Linda Tambuya's experience speaks to a broader issue in Fijian and Pacific society.
These are systems that are male-dominated, and that is the reason why when violence against women happens, people do not treat it as a crime, that it is a very serious crime. People get murdered within this.
In Fiji, domestic violence is widespread. Studies have shown around two-thirds of women in intimate relationships have been physically assaulted by their partners. Clara left her husband in 2019. But before that, she says she endured years of brutal violence that left her hospitalised.
I was swallowing blood. I got my tooth actually fall. I've got bruises on my body too, my face, black eye.
In PNG, UN Women estimates more than 1.5 million women will face gender-based violence every year, like Lorena, a victim of abuse from her estranged husband that left her with broken bones.
In the settlement, I think, like out of every 100 women, 99 of them go through violence. But they don't open up, they don't talk about it. I don't know, they're taking it as a normal thing or something.
In recent decades, laws in more than a dozen Pacific countries have enshrined greater protections for women and harsher punishment for abusers. But changes to the law mean little if police and courts don't enforce them. Constable Leah Ardi is a police officer in the Solomon Islands.
Some of our male colleagues have that cultural barrier that is embedded in them, where women are wrong. Women should respect their husbands by not provoking them.
University of Canterbury Associate Professor Yvonne Crichton-Hill says domestic violence in the Pacific comes from socio-economic issues like poverty, unemployment, as well as cultural norms that promote men's superiority over women.
Even a lack of skills and relationships. So, for example, not being able to manage conflict in a healthy way, or maybe individuals and families have had experiences of family violence themselves.
She says women need to lead responses to gender-based violence.
Views about women that actually hold up women and empower women and see the value of women.
Back in Fiji, the Women's Crisis Centre is doing just that, visiting villages and holding workshops addressing domestic violence. La, a victim of domestic violence herself, says that having open conversations that respect village culture has led to progress.
It is very important for us. It is important in the sense that we change the mindset of the men.
La from the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre, ending that report from Alice Lolahia. And if you're in an abusive situation or know someone who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. You're listening to AM, where it's 18 minutes past 7. Holidaymakers have been left thousands of dollars out of pocket and others stranded overseas following the collapse of an Australian travel company. Melbourne-based Travel Dream, which operated solely online, has been placed into administration, leaving customers scrambling for refunds on prepaid holidays. It's prompted warnings from industry experts about the risks of booking through unaccredited agents. National tourism reporter Christy Sexton-McGrath reports.
Queensland nurse Donna Lamberth has been dreaming of her and her partner Warren Banks' $19,000 trip for more than a year.
I just seen it on Facebook and like went in and did all their reviews and things, and it looked pretty good and everyone said how good it was. I was so hanging for it.
They were planning on going to Vancouver, the Rocky Mountains, Las Vegas, the Grand Canyon, and on an Alaskan cruise in July using an online travel company known as Travel Dream.
I had 2 months off work. I was finished the end of next month for 2 months, and it was just going to be great.
It was more than a holiday for the couple from Injune in Western Queensland. It was a personal turning point.
My brother passed away last year and I just went, you know what, life's too short. We're going to start doing a trip every year.
But it all fell apart when the Melbourne-based online travel company, registered Australian Travel Deals Proprietary Limited, collapsed late last month. Only the couple's international flights from Brisbane to Canada had been paid for. The rest of the booking, including the cruise, accommodation and internal flights, were never secured. Travel Dreams administrators McLeod broke the news of the insolvency in an email.
We just had to give them some information, but by the sounds of it, they don't have any money to give us, so I don't know where the money's gone.
The couple is not alone. Chris and Vicky Broughton from Sydney were planning a trip to celebrate Vicky's 70th birthday, exploring Yellowstone National Park, the Canadian Rockies, and cruising through Alaska. But after paying over $12,000, the pensioners too found their bookings never secured.
We've had no contact at all from Travel Dream. We've been contacted by the administrators and I suppose they'll end up offering us 10 cents on the dollar or something, but it's a real kick in the guts. We had to have visas to enter America, visas to enter Canada, bought special clothing for the cold, and actually today we're supposed to be in Alaska.
Both families say they had travel insurance with major providers who do not offer protection against insolvency. The Australian Travel Industry Association says Travel Dream was not a member when it collapsed, having been removed over concerns around directorship and finances in 2020. Here's the CEO of Attia, Dean Long.
There were two sets of concerns. There was a directorship concern and also a going financial concern that we had to cover off on as part of that process. When they failed to provide the relevant information that we require to maintain an accreditation under our scheme, they were removed from the scheme immediately. It does show the importance of making sure that you are using an accredited business, because if you're just going to shop on price without checking for quality or reassurance, it does increase the risk of these type of events happening.
The company is owned by Melbourne businessman Christopher Banson, who the ABC has contacted for comment. In a statement, the administrators McLeod estimate more than $1 million may be owed to customers. It's not yet known exactly how many people have been impacted. Despite the setback, Donna Lambert's determined to have her breakaway.
A bit pissed off, but this is what I said. There's nothing I can do about it. So I'm just back at work and we're planning on going on a holiday next year.
That's hopeful traveller Donna Lambert, ending that report by Christy Sexton-McGrath. The new leader of the Greens, Larissa Waters, is challenging the government to work with it to get legislation through Parliament. This term, the Greens will hold the balance of power in the Senate. In the last few years, the party's been accused of being obstructionist. Larissa Waters has signalled a change, saying she hopes to lead a party that's firm but constructive. Alison Schau reports.
They were linked arm in arm, four women who are now at the helm of the Greens Party. The new leader, Queensland Senator Larissa Waters.
People elected us to get shit done, and that's what we intend to do in the service of people and the planet.
Former party leaders Christine Milne and Bob Brown have praised the party's pick.
She is exactly the right person we need now to lead the Greens, and also Larissa's background as an environmental lawyer, as an incredibly collaborative person, highly intelligent, full of integrity, is just perfect.
So I think it's a great choice, and I think that Larissa will take it up to the big parties at a time when that's going to be needed more than ever before.
The Greens suffered some heavy blows at the federal election, losing three lower house seats, including that of former leader Adam Bandt. The party's losses were attributed by some to its identity shift from an old guard of tree huggers to a new wave party of renters that pursues activism on issues such as the war in the Middle East and support for the controversial union, the CFMEU. Bob Brown disagrees.
There's been a lot of nonsense talked about the Greens. We've always been for social justice. And of course that should be covered. But there's been a consistent stand by the Greens on the environment, which is not equal by any other entity in the parliament.
He says Senator Waters and the party needs to continue taking a strong approach.
I noticed the Prime Minister's already said, get out of the way. I've seen that even said by some environmentalists. But no, get in the way. Make progress by standing up to the people who want to worsen climate change, open more coal mines, burn more forests, and widen the gap between rich and poor. You've got to make a stand there.
But Larissa Waters is also considered by some to be less hardline and more of a negotiator than her predecessor, and says she'll take a firm but constructive approach. Former Labor MP and now political analyst at Queensland University of Technology, John McKell, believes Senator Waters will be more likely to seek compromises with Labor.
One of the criticisms of the Greens under Adam Bandt was they were seen to be too obstructionist. Her record in Queensland is one of being quite methodical without being a headline hunter. I think what she'll do is revert to the Bob Brown style of pro-environmentalism. That's where the Greens are strongest.
CEO of the Australian Conservation Foundation, Kelly O'Shaughnessy, hopes that's the case.
But at times I would have liked them to talk more about climate and nature than we did see in the last term. The whole party really needs to focus on their name, the Greens, and get back to really making sure that there's a big focus on nature and climate this term.
Rob Watts, who helped set up the Greens Party in Victoria, says Senator Waters will be able to steer the party's focus back to its core environmental message, but also hold fast to its social justice stance.
She, I think, offers the kind of combination of a focus on environmental issues, which I think the party probably is right to sort of get back to focusing more on. And I think she represents a quieter, more conciliatory kind of political style.
He points out that despite its depleted representation in the House of Representatives, the Greens still have significant numbers in the Senate.
I think that some of the pending decisions that the federal government's going to be making about Woodside, for example, the gas field up in northern Australia, will be a test both for the Labor government and particularly then for the Greens in the Senate. So this will be the test, I think, that the new leader of the Greens is going to have to rise to. And it'll be interesting to see how that happens and with what effect.
Professor Rob Watts from RMIT ending that report from Alison Shaw. And Sally Sara will speak to Senator Waters after 7:30 on Radio National Breakfast. Fresh from clinching a temporary tariff truce with China, the Trump administration is hoping for similar, more permanent agreements in Asia. Global markets rose this week after the US and China agreed to reduce crippling tariffs on each other for 90 days, and Southeast Asian countries are watching closely. Among them, Vietnam, which is facing one of the highest tariff rates if its leaders don't strike a deal with Donald Trump by mid-July. Our correspondent Bill Birtles filed this report from Ho Chi Minh City.
At a garment factory on the outskirts of Vietnam's biggest city, dozens of workers stitch together clothing for some of the world's biggest brands. Salaries here start at about $500 Australian a month, although 23-year-old Nguyen Ngoc An has almost doubled her income over 5 years at the factory.
I'm using the money I earn here to help pay for my younger brother to study. He's only 6 years old at primary school, so he has many years of schooling ahead of him.
Vietnam's economy and exports were growing already when Donald Trump first came to power in early 2017. His first-term tariffs on China prompted some foreign investors and factory owners to move operations south to Vietnam, and workers like Ngoc An picked up jobs. Now his threat to slug Vietnam with a 46% tariff on everything exported to the US makes her worried.
A lot of our exports go to the US, so if the tariffs happen, we won't sell as much and we won't earn as much.
Southeast Asia is in the crosshairs of the American president's tariff push, with Vietnam second only to Cambodia for the size of the proposed rate. Unlike China, which can restrict rare earths and inputs that US factories need, Southeast Asian countries are more vulnerable. Vietnam, for example, largely exports finished products like electronics, furniture, machinery and clothing. And its exports to the US are worth about 10 times the value of what Americans sell to Vietnam. But the garment factory owner, Henry Pham Quang An, thinks it's just not possible for Americans to start making clothing again.
I don't think that the people in the US will try to open the factory at Silver Lake. You need a supply chain. A lot of things. Not easy. Not only money.
Vietnam's Communist Party leader Tho Lam has proposed zero tariffs all around between the two countries, an idea that would still probably mean a big trade surplus. He's dispatched negotiators to Washington. And Ho Chi Minh City-based economist Yuen Tan Dien thinks a reduced rate will be the final outcome.
The most likely outcome is that Vietnam will lower tariffs on American goods and products where the US has an advantage, like technology, machinery and aeroplanes. And the US might put lower tariffs on products where we have an advantage, like garments.
Vietnam's state media says the country is among six nations given priority treatment by the White House for talks. So workers here are hoping for news of a deal soon. In the meantime, they're getting on with the job amid the uncertainty. This is Bill Birtles in Ho Chi Minh City reporting for AM.
Briefly in finance, the Australian dollar is weaker this morning at just over 64 US cents. That's AM. I'm Rachel Mealy. It's 7:30 and good morning, Sally Sara.
Thank you, Rachel, and good morning. This is Radio National Breakfast. Coming up, the new Greens leader, Senator Larissa Waters, will be my guest. The Greens party room meeting yesterday marked the end of an astonishing week where not one but three parties elected their leaders. Also later this half hour, with some counting still continuing, Australian Electoral Commissioner Jeff Pope is my guest. Let's have a look at the weather for the major centres today. In Broome, sunny and 33 degrees. For Perth, sunny and 26. Adelaide, a shower or two today and 19. If you're in Melbourne, you'll expect a possible late shower and 19 degrees. Hobart, showers developing, 16. Albury Wodonga, sunny today and 22. Canberra, possible shower, 19. Wollongong, a shower or two and 21. Sydney, shower or two, also 21 degrees. For Newcastle, you'll have a shower or two today and 22 degrees. Brisbane, showers and 23. Townsville, a shower or two and 29. Cairns, mostly sunny today, looking beautiful up north and a top of 30 degrees. In Darwin, sunny and 33. And for Alice Springs, a mostly sunny day and 22 degrees. Now, Luke Sidham-Dundon is back to bring you up to date with what's happening in the news this morning. Luke, good morning again.
Morning, Sally. The Trump administration isn't confident that peace talks in Turkey will deliver any progress on the war in Ukraine. Low-level Russian and Ukrainian delegations are set to meet for the first time since the full-scale invasion began 3 years ago, without the attendance of both countries' presidents. Vladimir Putin